Right, good evening, everyone. My name is Richard Stubbs. I'm Chief Exec of the Yorkshire and Humber Academic Health Science Network. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this, hopefully for you, final session for your day before these champagne corks start popping. We'll probably hear them in about 20 minutes from here. Thank you, everyone, for taking the time to be here. It's a really important agenda for us as an HSN network, and I do appreciate that we're up against other really compelling sessions, so your presence is really appreciated. I suppose my first order of business is to say, has everyone got one of these on their table? Because the idea today is to launch this document, so if you all have one in your hand, then at least 50% of our work is done. Thank you for that. So, why are we here? Well, hopefully you all are here to help us to do two things, really. One is to talk around the huge role and importance of diversity and how it plays into our innovation world within the HSN network. And the other is to celebrate some of our BAME innovators who are featured in our publication, and to kind of mix those two subjects and talk about why it's important as an HSN network, we feel, that we need to play a much stronger leadership role in terms of both, I suppose, identifying the bias inherent in the system when it comes to the selection of both innovations and innovators, but also making sure that the innovations that we support and nurture as an HSN network are those which are going to be suitable and accessible to all our populations. And we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. But before we crack on, I just want to introduce my fantastic panel, who have very graciously agreed to come and say a few words on this. So we have, from my right, immediate right here, we have Joan Sadler. Joan, I'm sure many of you in the room will know Joan, Associate Director of Partnerships and Equality at the NHS Confederation, leads on the NHS Confederation for Equality, Diversity and Inclusion, and probably most specific to this conversation, Joan was really the driving force behind the recent launch of the NHS Confederation's BAME Leaders Network, which, as I'll tell in just a short while, was instrumental in helping the HSN network then come to the fore and start to think about our role within this agenda. We've got Taz Olawad. So Taz will be known to many people in the HSN network, I think. He's a brilliant GP from Bradford who has, in addition to many other things, has developed an innovation called DocAbode, which I won't say too much about because I'm sure Taz will want to talk about that and his journey through that and why, as an innovation, it's one of those innovations which I suppose speaks to what I said about the challenge of making sure that we can be accessible and reach all our population. Next, we've got Naomi Marsambili, founder and CEO of CHORNA, which is a healthcare innovation organisation based in Liverpool. Again, I'm not going to say too much about that. And then we've got Wayne Farrer, who is co-chair of the NHS Confed BAME Leadership Network. And I'll let Wayne say a little bit about himself as well. So in a few minutes, and this is probably a heads up for both Joan and Wayne, because I've already explained to Naomi and Taz, the panel will just give 2 or 3 minutes reflections, starting with our innovators, about why we've featured them, what their story is, why this agenda is important to them, and then some reflections from Joan and Wayne from a more general sense, from a BME Leadership Network point of view. But before then, I guess just a word or two from me about, so why we got involved in this, why does the HSN Network think this is really important? Well, as I said, perhaps 12 months ago now, maybe a little bit longer, Joan gave me one of those conversations which, you know, you're used to. Can you give me some money? And then can you give me some support? And it's like, yes, of course, Joan. Why? And we talked about the BME Leaders Network. And actually, for me personally, I was thinking about sponsoring it from Yorkshire Humber HSN. And then I thought, well, actually, this should be something which the network comes together to do. And what was really interesting for me was it enabled me to think more deeply, in a way I probably should have done a few years ago, around the role of innovation and diversity and how, as an HSN network, we perhaps haven't been as loud and as forceful as we should have been around the fact that actually, as we enter this tipping point of transforming our service, you know, we're bringing in technologies around artificial intelligence, machine learning, artificial recognition, facial features, all those kind of things. We've got genomics, big data, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We perhaps haven't done as much as we ought to make sure that our in our rush to transform the system, we don't leave people behind, we don't leave communities behind. And I don't know if anybody's really saying too much about that. So as an HN network, that was our way into this topic, to say, well, actually, we want to be a big part of where that is. And from that point, 12 months ago, we've done a lot of work internally. I'm really pleased, actually, I should have said at the start, very grateful to my HSN chief exec colleagues for joining me on this journey. And they all chucked a bit of cash in, so I didn't have to find a whole lot myself. But actually, what I did is I asked them for a little bit more to say, well, actually, let's not just sponsor the network for the Confed, but let's also find ourselves a small fighting fund to do a bit of work ourselves around what this means to us as an HSN network. And the start of that is what you see before you today, but it is only the start, and I'll explain why that's the case in due course. I won't go into the entire thought leadership piece, but suffice it to say, as you'll read in the article, as you'll know in this room, 19.1% of all our staff are from a BME background. And that's one-fifth of the potential ideas and opportunities that we have in terms of how we can transform the way that we deliver our care. So there's an absolute requirement for us to not just focus on, you know, the great work that the RES is doing, the great work that that people like Prainer are doing on general workforce representation, but actually who's thinking about those really inferential innovation and improvement roles, both inside and just outside the service, and how are we making sure that those roles themselves are ones that, I suppose, encourage wider participation, are representative of the communities that we serve, and I suppose are cognizant of the types of inequalities that can be unintended consequences of some of the improvements that we're trying to make. So there's a degree of work for us to think about our representation as an HSN network, how we recruit our staff, how we make sure that the way that we engage with our communities is fair and equitable. But there's also something about making sure that the innovations that we help to develop and nurture are also things that aren't going to exacerbate inequalities in our system. And that's really where our journey begins. So please do read the article. I wrote it in a tent in Wales. I had to go and find solitude and a deadline. Those are the only two things that make me write anything, solitude and a deadline. But we'll talk a little bit about the pledges in more detail later. But for now, I think if I can turn to our innovators first. Taz and Naomi, I don't know if you've decided who's going to go first. Have you tossed a coin?
I don't mind, yeah.
So Taz, if you want to spend a few minutes just introducing yourself, just tell a bit about your story and why this is important to you.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Richard. Is this working? Hopefully you can hear me. Well, thank you very much for inviting me for a start. Real honour and a privilege to be here. My parents are both from Iraq, and I was actually born there, and they both came as junior doctors. And they came at a time during the Iraq-Iran war, actually. And they're very privileged to actually come over here and work, and they did their postgraduate degrees and things. And they really didn't want me to become a doctor, actually. But and my dad, I remember my dad actually he's a pathologist, and taking me into a post-mortem, trying to put me off at the age of 15. And I absolutely loved it. Just carrying the liver, and it was just amazing. So I absolutely, obviously became a doctor, but I was always very interested in business and management, and did an MBA while doing my GP training, and got very confused looks at people around me. Why is a doctor doing an MBA? But really much got involved in business and management, working for providers, CCGs, NHS England, kind of all those sorts of organisations. But pretty much the hardest thing I've ever done is found my own digital health startup in Dockerbode. And even the name itself, actually, for those of you that have read the article, it's actually named after a late mentor of mine who, again, was an Iraqi immigrant who created his own software company at the age of 35 and became very, very successful, and his product became global. And he actually set a deadline. And unfortunately, he had a very rare sort of cancer. And he said, you've really got to do something by the age of 35, because I had lots of ideas. And so I remember, on holiday, and I did my first Innovate UK funding application in Turkey, and got some money and actually put my idea into action. And that was 5 years ago. And it does take a lot longer than you ever think. But Dockerbode is effectively a way to engage the workforce, allow us to, I'm still a practicing GP, but I want to be able to contribute in a way that's flexible around my needs, my family, my work. And what we've done in the urgent care system is when there's a patient that requires help in that particular time, as a clinician, you're able to set your availability. You say how far you're willing to travel, and these are the most vulnerable, frailest people in society who are at home, who've already been through national triage systems. They need someone to see them quite quickly. And unfortunately, there are lots of delays in the system. And Docker opens up a whole workforce, and it doesn't. And you don't have to be a doctor. The provider, this isn't patient-facing. The provider then says, we've got a qualified person. It might be a heart failure nurse specialist, a palliative care nurse, or a GP who can see that patient in their own home. The clinician knows whether it's their own registered patient, they know how far away they are, and more importantly, things, it might be simple, but in this presentation, the language that someone speaks. So we flag up, because of the integration we have with the record system, that whatever is the patient's first language, because currently, so anyone turns up to that patient and it makes such a difference. So you could just accept people and see people. It might be your own patients within a set time from where you are. And those patients get seen much quicker, and it's based on the specialty and interest that you're qualified and interested to do. So we've proven this in out of hours. Actually, we're operational across West Yorkshire. And through the support of Richard and his team at the HSN, I really honestly couldn't have done it without them. I'm not saying that just because they're here. They believed in us 3 years ago now, proof of concept, and gave me that confidence with some funding and support from organisations to take it to the next level. We got some then serious funding, and we scaled up and we built a great product, and we're now spreading actually hopefully in this region and in the Northwest and hopefully beyond that. But it's narrowing those health inequalities that are really important to me as well, and just knowing my identity as well. You know, it's really difficult. I know my parents are Iraqi. I was born in Iraq, came here at the age of one. I moved around in Scotland because we grew up. I had the thickest Glaswegian accent you could imagine. Moved to England from primary to secondary school, and you sort of lose your identity, and it's a real issue at the moment. So I think actually I've been really kind of, I don't know, there was a whole time with the Gulf War, I was actually quite scared about talking about where I was from because, you know, people didn't understand what was going on in that area. And actually things like this have just made it really, you know, I don't know, it feels great being able to talk about my heritage because I just haven't done that in a way. Wow. And I get confused from anything from Mediterranean to Jewish to whatever it might be. And you know what, it's great that I can fit in anywhere. But I also, you know, my wife's English, but our kids are a mixture of all cultures and hopefully getting a bit of both. But as an innovator, it's been fantastic working with people in Richard's team. And again, just understanding patients are critical to really getting how, you know, we can get our innovations into the right hands. And obviously, as a workforce, if we don't understand issues around the BAME community, you're never going to be able to build solutions and understand some of the nuances and differences to enable your product to be successful and to bring benefit to patients.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Tas.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Naomi.
Hello, everybody. So I've got a link with you, Taz. Okay. I was born in Bradford.
Oh, fantastic.
So there's a nice link there. So yeah, I was born in Bradford to a father who came here on a scholarship from Tanzania. I studied at Bradford Uni, and a mum who was born in Bradford, and her mother came over here as Jamaican and actually spent quite a lot of time of her life in a mental health institution in Bradford. So there's a lot of links. So I guess, looking back, my first experiences of the NHS aren't that positive in thinking about how they could potentially meet the needs of my grandmother and wider people within my family. So not knowing what to do, I went to study psychology, as you do, to understand a little bit more, and then worked in research. And then there was an introduction of IAPT, which is Improving Access to Psychological Therapies, which was training a lot of psychological therapists. And so in the first wave I moved down to London and trained to be an IAPT worker. And I was one of the few specialist workers who was designated to work with African and Caribbean communities in Hackney. And so I not only worked and did my clinical work, but also worked to set up culturally adapted therapies in Hackney by going out, working with community organisations, setting up black men's groups, working with young groups, And there wasn't a training course for black therapy or African therapy. And actually the conversations that I had within my department were incredibly difficult to justify that work as well. So I had to go and read, I had to go and research, I had to travel and think about my own experiences and bring that into my clinical work. I then moved to South London and Maudsley and set up a community development service within there. And it was the time of another big campaign of the Delivering Race Equality, well, it was the back end of the DRE. And the work that I did there, I guess, made me fall in love with community-based organisations, but get incredibly frustrated by the fact often there was martyr leaders, so people who loved what they were doing, but not necessarily evidencing the work that they were doing and able to compare it with the NHS, and be able to have maybe equal power relationships in providing service that was appropriate and adequate for people within the community. So started to look at maybe different mechanisms, and I'm an ideas person, too many ideas. In my head and find a problem and look for an idea. And that doesn't always work with a quite rigid culture and a target-driven culture, which IAPWD is increasingly becoming. So I set up a social enterprise to provide community-based psychological therapies and training and worked across mainly South London. We were commissioned by trusts that I'd worked at. We received funding from Time to Change. We provided services to housing associations. On the outside of it, I was smiling when we were doing it, and the inside, I was crying. I was burnt out because I was still overdoing what I should be doing. I was still trying to figure out how you fix that model of being able to, I guess, address healthcare inequalities in the community with a range of populations, but often working in broken markets and with little resources and often maybe a deficit of skill to be able to work in that way and not, I suppose, the desire to do that as well. As clinicians, people love their rooms and their buildings and going out and seeing people often can be quite an alien concept, especially now. So I guess it was 2015 where I had to step back and think, okay, what am I interested in? How can I and a team around me work to be able to come up with an idea, look at how that can be implemented, find the resources, and then put that out there, quite simply. So myself and my friend who I studied with at university, Megan Charles, we set up Chinua to work on a range of projects to support people access mental health provision, and that could be anything, so it wasn't necessarily just therapy, and use technology in a way that could complement that work, and it was human-centered and human-driven. And so now we work on a range of different projects. One of the projects that I guess is within my brief is NeuroChampions, and we work specifically to look at, I guess, preventative and early intervention area of support. So NeuroChampions works with young people, all ranging from the age of 8 all the way up to 25, to support them to understand themselves through training them up in the areas of the brain. So we incorporate neuroscience, we incorporate the links between emotions and mental health. We support them to use technology for good by thinking about how they can create, whether it's animations, use 3D printing to create brains, to create fidget spinners, and then, you know, reward them with a certificate of their learning. And so we have curated over the past 3 years a young leaders program that was supported by the Wellcome Trust. And we've created a range of different games that we have within the program. So we deliver them within schools and community organizations. We work with Alder Hey Children's Hospital to deliver a program in there. And we're creating more and more digital games now. So we've received some social investment to create digital games for children and young people's mental health. And so I guess I'm encouraged by the report. I've also seen a lot of reports, and I love when reports that I see now have the information that was potentially in them 10 and 20 years ago as well, because we've been saying a lot of the same thing for a long time. And one of the things that breaks my heart is the fact that the information, the legacy is often lost. You know, there's a lot of great practice that's actually out there that's been done to think about how we can build the capacity of people from Black, Asian and migrant communities, how we can think about the inequalities of care. But we are in a very different time now. We're in a technological era. Socially, we're in a very different time where our environment around us, our political environment, is having an impact on our health and well-being. People are living longer, which is great, but there's a range of different complex healthcare problems and challenges that are coming from that. So I think the lens that we look at the solutions needs to bring in more people. And I know we talk about BME innovators, but I also talk about young innovators as well. So I work with young people and I have young researchers, and often young people often come into the NHS or come into health at an entry level. And so don't have the power to implement some of their ideas. And they've got some great ideas. Mm. And so therefore now, maybe training up and leaving the NHS and setting up their own companies and setting up their own organisations so they can have the environment where they can put those innovations into practice. And so I hope part of this report will, and even the fact that we've got us two here that are innovators that have set up businesses, encourages different people in the NHS to work and nurture the talent that often is within you and wants to work to solve the challenges that we're seeing. So, yeah. That's me. Thank you.
I think you're next, Jeremy.
Well, I'm tired. I remember having that kind of energy. And it is wonderful to see and hear that you're taking the reins. You know, this is what leadership is, isn't it? And when we had that conversation, sometimes you have conversations and kind of you have them and then yeah, that's it. And what is really good about Richard, your AHSN network, is that you've moved and you've done this within what, 8 months, 9 months? It's doable. We can do things in the NHS that don't take 10 years or five. So I just want to really congratulate you and to kind of motivate you to continue. You know, you're future leaders, actually. That's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm seeing. When you talked about Bradford, you talked to, you know, we've been through Bradford, Turkey, Iraq, Jamaica, Scotland, Northwest, Wales. Wayne will talk about Bristol. You know, I'm from Leeds.
Yeah.
Come on. We are all over the place. We are not mono people. You know, that's when we think about diversity in all its shapes and forms. We just think of these silos of people. Mm. We're everywhere. We are disabled. We have different sexualities. We are different colors. We come from different places. You know, that is essentially, equality is essentially innovation. Mm. Mm. Yeah. So yeah. Why aren't we harnessing it?
Exactly.
Why aren't we harnessing it? Just three things I suppose I would say is it's important, Richard and your network, to be documenting those models, because these are models. Mm. The evidence will continue to matter, and so that's what you're building as well. And then there's something about translating that into almost that competitive edge that gives us the transformation we're looking for now. The NHS cannot continue in the way it's continuing. It needs these innovations, and certainly having run a community organisation, having chaired a primary care trust, you know, having worked at national level, I come back to the people making the difference on the ground are those community organisations stroke innovators who may be private sector social enterprise, but they are bringing a level of flexible and personalised care you can't possibly do in a national kind of monochronistic way. There are some good things to that. You know, A&E, we need kind of services that kind of can give that up-to-the-minute care now, but we need to harness this, and this is what I see you doing here. So I'm really, really glad people like you are doing what you're doing, and please continue, your future leaders. Yeah, really.
Thank you.
Yeah, just wanted very simply to add a couple of thoughts, really. When we established the BME Leadership Network, the challenge was to take on the NHS deficit model around equality. And what I've heard today is just complete confirmation that we were right.
Yeah.
Yes. That, you know, and we set out simply to say, how do we develop a more robust approach to equality, diversity, and inclusion that goes beyond repeating the same reports every 3 years on a 30-year cycle? And how do we bring together leaders to begin to challenge the system? And I think what I've heard today is very much sort of confirms the kind of principles that we set for the network, which is about showcasing excellence and achievement. It's about celebrating best practice. challenging the NHS to improve performance and in order to deliver better patient care and better patient outcomes. And I think that's the bit too often gets left out of the conversation. And provide role models as well for future leaders. And I think what I've heard today is, you know, in a very short time, you've been able to establish a record of achievement,
yep.
You know, which absolutely fits into what we are saying is just core business for us. For any of those who run those community organisations who just know, you know, how do you deal with a deficit? Yeah, it's just what you do. And I just wanted to say, you know, finding solutions, that innovation, you know, which again is just core business and we kind of do it so much. And I just want to just say, the other aspect is about modelling that leadership. You know, and I would just like to pay tribute to Richard in the sense of actually showing all of us exactly how we can go about modelling that leadership as a way that nurtures the next generation of leaders who will have and do have all the skills and resources required to transform the NHS so that our communities are no longer marginalised, no longer overlooked, no longer excluded.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got time for some questions or even just comments and remarks. Does anybody have anything to raise in the audience?
Thank you. This has just been really great to hear all of your perspectives. I'm wondering what you individually, or I suppose, what would you say? What do you think are the biggest obstacles that are standing in the way of really transformative change?
Who wants to go first?
What an easy question.
One of the biggest obstacles is will. So I run a PCT in Waltham Forest. It didn't meet any of its targets. It had some really terrible, you know, indications of ill health. And we said, okay, we haven't got any money. Let the clinicians lead. Let them go and do what they know is best for this community. Bring in leaders. There were none when I got there within 18 months. There was no diverse leadership. And I tell this story a lot because it's possible. We had three executives who were BME, and we had the most diverse board in the UK. For me, it was shocking that became such a prominent thing, right? So Will says you can do this, and you can empower people by just the expectation. I didn't go out and look for people. I just said to my chief exec, this is terrible, isn't it? She said, yeah. White chief exec. And within 18 months, we had that kind of board in Waltham Forest, which is at least 25 to 30% BME, right? So if our leaders really have the will to work in this way, we can. I'm not saying it's easy. I think it's easy. But will is a big issue. Yeah.
Well said. I think, I mean, I've already ranted about this already today because I had a few meetings where this question has been asked, and for me, it's culture. It's always down to culture. I mean, there's, and on this particular topic, I mean, there's so many rooms that you're in where you realise, usually after the event, that nobody in that room even bothers to ask questions. Everybody always assumes that the answers must be within these four walls, and there's nobody else who needs to be in the room before questions need to be asked. And I think these kind of examples, or the kind of examples that are in the publication, are where those aren't the rooms that are asking for these solutions. They don't understand the challenges even exist, never mind the solutions that may come forward. So the challenge for us is, how do you either break into those rooms or make those rooms obsolete?
Okay, I like the last one.
I guess also, sorry, just to add, I'd say on a research perspective, the concept and the methodologies of evidence base don't work in practice, and especially with technology, the technology timeline of creating technology and implementing it is much quicker than any type of healthcare research process. So by the time you've even got to ethics, if you are doing ethics, in the community, you could have built an app, you could have created your algorithm, you could have sourced data from a range of different places, you could have done all that at a very low cost. And so I think a big barrier around getting effective technologies into practice is the timelines and the methodologies in technology. I think there's also personally the element of around credibility. You have an NHS badge instantly, even if you're rubbish, you have credibility. Absolutely. And I say that quite flippantly, but I know when I was working in the NHS, I could open a lot more doors than what I can from the outside. And what I have to do to justify and prove the credibility of what I do and my work is very different. So we spend a lot of time doing that. I get paid less than what I did when I was working in the NHS for myself, but there's an assumption because you're an organisation, whether that's private sector or social enterprise, you're making loads of money, and you want to make loads of money and you're evil. And so, you know, how you can boundary that, and there can be more transparency, because the majority, and I do loads of mentoring of startups, organisations, people aren't generating, especially the founders, you know. It's not massive money making, and especially in healthcare, because it's so hard to evidence-based and demonstrate what you're doing. Unless you get a big grant from Wellcome, Innovate, SRI, you know, from other places that can allow you to then do that development and that research and development, you need to be able to test it, iterate it, and have the luxury and the time to be able to do that. Often, people are working very frugally and driven by their own interests, frustrations, or personal experiences. And I think also just when thinking about finances as well, and research and putting in bids, you could spend a lot of time writing funding bids. It's actually a PhD level skill to write an effective bid. And I question, and again, I'm on SSE trustees and I'm on the grants committee, I question how much of the bids are actually, especially these 26-page ones, are actually read. And could we harvest that time more effectively for innovators internally within the NHS, but also externally, to be working on the innovations that they want to work on, rather than filling in endless numbers of forms and attending events to learn how to write grant bids?
So. I think I'd just add a couple of thoughts. I think, you know, the barriers are around entrenched interests and privileges.
Yeah.
You know, they don't just disappear at the you know, as an act of wishful thinking. And part of that, I think, is that gives rise to a limited vision, limited expectation as to what can be achieved and how it can be achieved. And that takes us back to, it's part of that is our capacity to see how to deconstruct some of those interests and those privileges. So that we open the doors wider. And I think, for me, part of the way that we can build upon our capacity in that sense is to think about... I've just had this thought from listening to you two just now. It's about innovation with roots. Because I think what you showed me was, you know, the innovation didn't spring out, you know, from... an abstract idea one day, but actually came out of, you know, a journey, and a journey of struggle, and a journey of encountering those barriers and encountering how inequalities are created and how they play out on a day-to-day. So I think there's something, and I don't quite know how to express it more articulately than that, but there's something about innovation with roots.
Yeah, nice.
I couldn't agree more. Just one with Naomi. I've not paid myself a penny. I've taken a massive pay cut as a founder. I still haven't taken a salary despite a lot of funding. Yeah. So, you know, people don't quite realise the personal sacrifice you make as an innovator as well. Innovation with the roots, absolutely. Everyone's got a story to tell. I think having a problem, because there's a lot of people with ideas that don't quite get what the real problems are. Yeah. And you don't really know what the problems are. Luckily for me, I'm privileged enough to deal with patients, you know, and a lot of patients that we see in general practice. Yeah. When you understand the real root of a problem or an organisation, it's actually easier to come up with a solution. Right. So if you're actually built that way and you've got a bit of entrepreneurial flair, you can see the solutions. And actually, It's unfortunate, I don't know if the person asked the question, that they weren't in that session we had this morning, because it was all around the challenges around this and spreading adoption of innovation. And I was sat at a great table. There were nurses, physios, a whole bunch of great people from the HSNs and industry. And actually, I think you started off saying, Richard, it was culture. And it is people. Unfortunately, we are your biggest sort of, you know, you find a blocker, that's the worst thing, yeah. You know, or you find, you know, an accelerator, that's great. It sometimes takes that if you want to YouTube the dancing man, it's a great video, you know, about you need those first or second people just to move and start, and people will follow. So I think people are, you know, one of your key assets, but also, you know, they can be big blockers, and actually trying to find the right door in the NHS is really difficult. It's a massive challenge, and it's really frustrating as innovators, and I'm still within the NHS tent, so you know, I feel some of your pain.
Thanks, Taz. I just want to finish. Oh, sorry, Anne, you were going to come in. Just wait for the mic, because we've got time. We've got time. We've always got time for NHS England.
Hello, Anne Bynes from NHS England. I've worked with Richard on and off for 6 years, so congratulations, Richard, and the panel for doing this work. I suppose it's a query around the HSN network. I mean, HSNs have been talked about at every session I've been at today. They are clearly a key change agent with the localities, the networks that they're pulling together, so much more than the national commissions that we actually give. I suppose it's just understanding. It's brilliant that the network have done this. About how they're going to challenge themselves in terms of how they operate going forward. Because I know we sort of caught up briefly a couple of months ago, and we noted that the network has just appointed through its annual process a new chair and vice chair. And that just happens to be two white, middle-aged men from Oxford and Cambridge. Ooh. And I don't decry
Very
Gary...
Very represented Democrat.
And I don't decry... You know, this isn't in any way to diminish Gary or Piers, who I have huge respect for in the network. But it's just... It's interesting, isn't it? And so it's that sort of challenge to the network itself and how the network will go forward and operate. And obviously the answers might be in here, perhaps.
Well, it's a lovely segue. Thank you very much for that. Because you're absolutely right. We have to start with ourselves. And I think that's the thing that I was most grateful for in terms of how we took this to our network, that people recognise that we have to start with ourselves. And I know Gideon's going to come in, but just to pick up on these pledges, and I won't go into them in any detail, but absolutely, you know, it starts with us. Yeah. And it starts with ensuring that we do two things. You know, we have a process of self-assessment that we understand that we're following best practice within ourselves as employers, but also in terms of our staff. You know, we have to be as representative of the communities that we serve as anybody else has to be in the NHS. And actually, what's interesting about the HSNs is, and I don't think we've done any deep analysis on this, but I think just by anecdote, you sense that HSNs are places that have jobs on the higher end of the gender change spectrum than elsewhere. You know, there's senior teams, there's senior clinicians who work in HSNs, et cetera. We're probably not, you know, the bell curve or whatever for an HSN is not quite as it looks for the rest of the service. That in itself is interesting in terms of the talent pipeline. Because when you're looking for people to come into jobs that are incredibly complicated, you know, do you know industry, do you know the NHS, do you know academia, can you put them all together in a coherent whole, can you be resilient enough to take all the brickbats from the service every single day asking, but what have you done for us lately? So to find the right calibre of person at those senior leadership levels who are ready now, you know, we know we've got a pipeline problem anyway, and so I think that gives us an even greater problem. It's not a problem we're going to shirk, but I think there is a problem within that. And then obviously the thing that's most important for me is our work. So recognising the impact that we have. And one of the great things about the network is, you know, we have more than found our feet, which is lovely. But what that means that our work is going to have a greater impact than it ever has done. And particularly when you look at the national programmes that we all deliver across the entire country, we're now at the stage of saying, if you plug in a national programme at this end, within 2 years, that's going to be happening everywhere. So the unintended potential consequences of that is huge, and I think we need to take that responsibility far more seriously. And that's why, you know, one of our pledges is to make sure that we have equality analysis on all our national programmes. Yeah. And, you know, we're asking for forgiveness here, not permission from NHS England, because I don't think we flagged this to you at all, but I think it's inherent on us to make sure that we do that. And so that's what we're going to be doing. We'll be doing it starting with our next cohort of national programmes, because actually, if we are as successful as we are starting to be, then, you know, these programmes are going to have real weight and a real impact on all our communities, so we need to make sure that they're right. Gideon.
Cool. I'm the chair of one of the Academic Health Science Next Works, one in the Northwest Coast. I really just on behalf, I think, of the 15 Academic Health Science Networks, if I may, to thank you enormously. This is a really important, really timely piece of work. Very, very, very welcome. As you've said, Richard, we are on the cusp of fantastic transformational developments, but we need to make sure they are inclusive, and this is a really timely catalyst, I think, for all of us in the networks to take on board what you've said very seriously. There are pledges, there are actions, there are a way of monitoring this. Mm-hmm. So this shouldn't be one of those ones that's left on the shelves there. That was nice.
No.
But between us, and certainly as one of the chairs, I shall certainly pledge to be doing this to support you and other colleagues to really make this a reality. So thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank you, Gideon. No, thank you for that. And I will be held to account for this. I mean, we all as chief execs will be held to account. I'll be personally holding myself to account for the delivery of this across the network. We will be back, obviously not to Expo 2020, because that's not going to exist, but we'll be back in some way to make sure that we report out on our first year of work in due course as well. On the subject of thanks, because time is against us, just to thank, actually, and quite a few people in the room, we had an enormously energetic and very insightful team of volunteers from across several of our HSN network colleagues who came together to do this at some pace. You know who you are. There's one person who's not here who I want to give particular thanks to, which is Vanessa, who has been absolutely just unbelievable as one of our comms leaders in just turning words into something which looks just so fantastic on the page. I think she knows how grateful we are to that work. Just also to say, as I said at the start, this is the start of something. So we had a long debate at the start of this process. Do you tackle all aspects of diversity, or do you start here and move on? We thought that actually what we wanted to do is shine a spotlight on each of the protective characteristics one at a time. So we're going to commit to coming back to this agenda and starting to think, well, what's the next bit of thought leadership? What's the next role that we need to play there? So you do look out for that. And I suppose just to finally finish by thanking our panel, who have given us such a great insight into their worlds. You have 2 minutes before both champagne corks start popping at the network stand. You're all invited to the HSN network stand just downstairs for our drinks party, which starts at 6. We are told Simon may be brushing by for some remarks, so if you didn't catch him earlier and you want to have the cribbed version, then now is the time to go. But thank you very much for sticking with us, and hopefully I'll see you on our stand. Thank you.